right. Welcome, listeners, to a special bonus episode of Know Your Enemy. It's me, Sam Adler Bell. Matt is not here, but I am here with Pat Blanchfield, one of my very favorite freelance writers, an associate faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, the author of the forthcoming book, Gun Power, from Verso, and an all-around genius jack of many trades and a master of many. So welcome to Know Your Enemy, Pat Blanchfield.
Hey, well, it's an absolute pleasure to be on. I'm humbled and also delighted to be here, and particularly humbled by that. Otto Kernberg, the psychoanalyst, at one point, like his, I don't know if he does this joke frequently or whatever, but he begins every like response to someone introducing him by saying, "Your introduction inspired me to write a paper on the topic of idealization."
So Pat has already let the cat out of the bag. This is the long-awaited Freud pod episode of Know Your Enemy. We're going to be diving deep into the uses of Freudianism and psychoanalytic theory for understanding politics, right-wing politics, left-wing politics, liberalism, fascism, communism. As Matt said in the last episode, he's grateful that I'm doing this bonus by myself so he can stop listening to me talk his ear off about Freud. And Pat is partially responsible for that because during the pandemic, one of the things that Hannah, my girlfriend, and I did with our time was take not one, not two, but three classes with Pat at the Brooklyn Institute on Freud, the early Freud, the late Freud, and Freud in politics. And if you read my work or you read Hannah Gold's work, you'll see the influence of Pat and Freud all over for the past few months, or the past year even. We've become totally Freud-pilled, thanks in part to Pat. So thanks, Pat, and sorry, my readers and listeners.
I'm sorry for you all. You both too. I mean, like, I you do me honor. I'm glad to be able to help spread the plague, as Freud famously said. I should say too, yeah, like I love psychoanalysis stuff. I love teaching psychoanalysis stuff. I love writing about it. I can't put to words how much it meant to me to come on to the first episode you all did now, which like 2 years ago, right? I think.
Yeah, let me plug that for a second. It's episode 7 of Know Your Enemy was Pat's first appearance on the podcast. It was called Gun Power, and it was engaged with the work that Pat does most frequently in your writing and your research, which is on America's relationship with guns and violence. And it's still one of my favorite episodes of Know Your Enemy. It was the first one that we put out with Dissent, and so it was sort of introducing the podcast to a much wider audience, and we were lucky that Pat was the person to do that with. If you haven't listened to that episode, please go back. I will get Pat to talk a little bit about guns and violence and territory and colonialism and how that relates to the America we have today during this podcast, but we won't go over all the same ground we did back then. But it's really an incredible episode. Please go back and listen to that.
Yeah, it was just an amazing experience for me, to be honest. I still hear from people about it too, and I think the reason I bring it up is both just to continue to plug and support your programming, but also to say that my perspective, and specifically the perspective that I brought to bear talking with you all and that animates my work on gun violence and trauma, is fundamentally about psychoanalytic. Like, that's just what I breathe at this point. So this is cool to be able to like letting the cat out of the bag.
Well, so just to clear our throat even more here, I did want to say that one of the reasons that I've been wanting to do this is that since I started reading Freud in earnest again the past 2 years, I've found the categories that Freud makes available and that psychoanalysis in general, other psychoanalytic thinkers make available, so useful for making sense of American politics these days. I can't even imagine like reading the news without having some of these conceptual tools that we'll get to in my toolbox. One of the lines that gets thrown around a lot is that psychoanalysis is, quote, a rational science of the irrational. And that was what Freud set out to do. We can problematize that at some point, but also I think in making sense of American politics and global politics today and the state of capitalism, I really can't imagine not having a way to deal with irrationality that feels like it doesn't just make my head spin and leave me at loose ends, which is what psychoanalysis and Freud provides to me. And, you know, I mean, I think one thing I want to say at the front here is, like, this isn't going to be, you don't need to be a Freudian to appreciate this. You don't need to have a whole bunch of psychoanalytic knowledge at all. We're going to start from a very basic starting point. And we're not treating it as a dogma. It's really like it provides frameworks and patterns of inquiry that are extremely helpful for making sense of contemporary politics, including many of the themes that we address on Know Your Enemy most of the time. So with that, I'm going to ask Pat to give us a little starting, maybe unzip the conceptual tool bag that we're going to be using today.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. And I think I want to like mirror back to you, I think, like the ways in which there's, I do think thinking with an eye towards either psychoanalytic concepts or problems that psychoanalytic sensitivity makes more legible, yeah, or at least highlights as a problem, is something that you can do whether or not you endorse any particular school of psychoanalytic thought, whether or not you even bother to read some people,
whether you're as invested in infant sexuality.
Yeah, exactly. Like I think part of what's one thing that psychoanalysis gives us, and I'll explain this more in a second, but like everything, particularly, you know, the Trump phenomena exemplarily, like the guy's walking around literally talking about the size of his penis and the flow rate of toilets and then pivoting seamlessly to talk about how big and hard the wall is and how we're being invaded from the south, like our porous southern borders, we with these walls that we can't depend on. Like it's complete, yeah, you know, anal retentive stuff. But you don't need...
And his speeches are basically word association. They're basically...
Yeah, he's free associating. He's traversing certain types of things and he's just there. But like, we don't even need to like you know any of that like jargon or like think about these terms to perceive like that. Well, here's what I want to say. Part of what psychoanalysis is about thinking about phenomena that are overdetermined, right? And that's a term that people use in a lot of different ways, and it means a bunch of things at once. One, it can mean like stuff that's like overwritten or full of meanings, right? Like when someone says like, do you believe in the Constitution? They're not asking you a propositional question. They're asking you an overdetermined question about the contents of it. It stands in for that, like all that type of stuff. So things that are overdetermined or that can be read multiple ways or are overcoded, like that's one thing that psychoanalysis is big into exploring. But the other way to think about overdetermination, which psychoanalysis is also big into thinking about, is about the way phenomena can have multiple causes at once. And yeah, we can't necessarily isolate any given one, but we perceive their dynamic interaction.
Right.
You know, in this moment where it's like, why is this happening? Why are certain people behaving this way? Where did this come from, et cetera? You don't have to have a unitary, singular, grand unifying theory explanation of it. You can just explore the complexities of the different things that come into it and the different ways that people get upset about it, the different angles of overdetermination rather than like adjudicating between them.
Exactly. Yeah. I think about the name of Chris Hayes's podcast, Why Is This Happening? And whatever single answer is given by his guest is going to be inevitably insufficient. And psychoanalysis is one of the ways it helps us deal with that dissatisfying nature of reality, is that there will not be one answer. Political scientists have a really hard time with this. You know, when we look at an election, like the election in Virginia, we go, why did this happen? Well, it has to be either CRT or the closed schools or masks, or it's got to be one of these things, one thing more than the other. Of course, the like really bedeviling, interminable, to use a term Freud also liked, example from recent political history is, why did Trump get elected? It's either because of racism or because of economic insecurity or because of patriarchy or because of just this pool of cruelty that exists in the American populace that was unleashed. And overdetermination is a way to understand that no, these things happen for many, many reasons which are interrelated and complex, and in fact, if you look at them closely, illuminating ways.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then I think this brings us back to what you put so astutely and paradoxically, this idea of like a science of the unrational, right?
Yes.
Or the science of unreason. And I think like if I were to define like, so if we were to define like what psychoanalysis is more generally.
Please do.
A lot of the jokes that Freud tells in like his jokes book, which are like classic Central European Jewish jokes, are also jokes that psychoanalysts also tell about themselves, right? So like, ask five psychoanalysts for a definition of psychoanalysis, you'll get 10 opinions, whatever, right? But like one ecumenical way of thinking about it is that like it's a body of knowledge and a tradition of inquiry, right? So it's not just one narrow discipline, inaugurated by this fellow Sigmund Freud at the turn of the 20th century, and that was subsequently elaborated by his interlocutors and subsequent schools and disciplinary perspectives within this, but that involves both clinical practice and theories of mind that are related to what are pathologies, how do pathologies arise, how do you treat them through talking, like basically any therapy at this point in which the relationship matters as a successor to the relationship between the patient and or the client,
yeah.
And the practitioner matters as a successor to that. But it's also like more abstract theories of mind and like applied thinking about everything from the arts to political formations. And there's certain themes and concepts that cut through all of those. But if I had to sum it up in like one sentence, right, like a basic way of seeing how everything sort of follows from this, which is that the individual person is not reducible to their rationality, right, or is not exclusively rational, and individuals themselves contain multitudes,
yeah,
or are even divisible, right? So put even more pithily, right, like it's not exclusively about rationality, and individuals aren't, right? Individuals are plural.
Yes. The first track on Bob Dylan's new record is called I Contain Multitudes. I recommend everybody listen to it. Bob Dylan, a great Jewish and then later a Christian thinker, so appropriate.
I think channeling Whitman, too, in that phrase,
oh,
right?
Well, absolutely, like, yes.
Just to flesh that out for a second more, like a lot of people like would traditionally, prior to Freud, and even now, will kind of offer like accounts that oppose the individual to the group.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There is individual psychology, then there's group behavior, the group dynamics, mm-hmm. right? And the individual and the group are separate entities for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And
a lot of disciplines.
Yeah, a lot of disciplines. I mean, and we think about, right, and the individual acts rationally,
mm-hmm.
right? The individual maximizes their self-interest, right, et cetera. And then the group presumably reflects that or distorts it in some other way,
right?
But any type of story that we tell that marshals these two things, the individual and then the group to which the individual can belong or maybe forced to belong, like is going to involve that initial distinction between the individual and the group.
Right. Freud says no.
Freud says no. And I think the psychoanalytic interjection or response would be that first, like about that individual, at no point is the human person like a monad or like a brain in a vat,
mm-hmm.
or an autonomous, self-legislating, contracting,
unencumbered subject.
Yes. Whether we view it as like the individual agent of like libertarian politics or the contracting subject of a certain type of liberalism or any of these other sort of like visions, the individual is never just that. And in fact, the individual, like to talk of the individuals exclusively being that or to ground our understandings of political life around just that fact is a kind of fantasy, right? Because contrary to the individual being this sort of fully autonomous, you know, what Cartesian cogito, who, you know, like the brain in the vat, whatever, who acts dispassionately, the individual is a person who is born in a given place of time, and their identity and their sense of subjectivity is constituted by the relationships to other individuals that surround them in their earliest years,
right.
And that continually sort of like literally become part of them.
Right.
Right. So one way to think about this might be is that like, as opposed to being like an abstract self, your identity is constituted by other relationships over time,
right.
And you emerge from that matrix of relationships.
Right.
And so that's really important for a lot of reasons. And the one thing I think we could flag right off the bat is like a lot of those relationships aren't voluntary.
Right.
Like the family quintessentially. And by the way, this isn't like a normative endorsement of like what a family has to be. It could be different parental caregivers,
yeah.
Like it could be institutions. But the point is that you are born and you don't have any choice where you're born or to whom you were born.
Right.
And those people around you are the most important people in the world one way or another.
Right.
And your understanding of what is normal or what is not normal is going to be affected by that nucleus of identifications.
Right.
And very literally the way you develop in certain theories, stuff like a conscience or a sense of who you are or should be is by the way that they model things or you affirm things or your own relationships play out.
Right. There's a line I think I read in an interview with Eli Zaretsky, the historian of psychoanalysis, where he said, the fundamental idea that underlies psychoanalysis is the prolonged nature of human infancy, the interpersonal forms of dependency that infancy entails, and the persistence of those forms throughout the life cycle. So this is placing a lot more than we've done so far on the period of being a helpless baby. But if we understand that our relationships are informed, ultimately, like, in sequence by each relationship that we have and the affects and longings, desires, and needs that arise in those relationships, obviously the experience of infancy and the relationship to the mother and the father or the caregiver of some sort and the other, and whoever else is around is going to be important. And one of the things that I take from that little pithy idea from Zaretsky is that psychoanalysis is also in effect an account of the persistence, at least psychically, of human vulnerability. That our earliest experiences of vulnerability, dependence, longing, loss, the fear of loss, continue to shape our personalities and our ways of relating to each other forever. And so one of the things that I like about thinking about it in those terms is that, first of all, it's not a specifically Freudian idiom, but also Matt's not here, but one of his concepts of the human is invested in a Catholic theological idiom where we are all born in original sin. We are fallen. We are vulnerable and dependent from the start. And while, of course, as we may get to, Freud was unapologetically anti-theist, I think this is a way for maybe some of our listeners, I'm aware of the overrepresentation of believing Christians who listen to this podcast, that the persistence of vulnerability and dependence from birth and the indelible imprint of that vulnerability on our psychic and relational life is also something that psychoanalysis illuminates and is principally based on.
Absolutely. I think that's a lovely way of putting it. And one way to think about like what a consequence of just like stressing this interdependence or this fact of vulnerability is to think about how that matters in the sense that even as we can be wont to talk as adults in very abstract ways about things like authority, right, or respect for others, right,
yes.
or invested in certain hierarchies that are very, very adult,
yes.
Like from, you know, like voting, right? Our first encounters with the idea of authority, questions of punishment, transgression, basic feelings of what's appropriate and what isn't,
yeah.
are never actually abstract. They're always fundamentally personal.
Yes.
They're dependent on others, and the way others look at us shape how we view ourselves.
Yeah.
This is the key way in which like individuals being multitudes or not even really being individuals or so divisible, right, is that those persist and those are axes by which political mobilization can happen across people.
Mm-hmm.
And also that can cash out in terms of that first sort of bit of my pithy definition there, which is the ways in which people are not reducible to rationality,
yes.
insofar as that those templates for identification, those understandings of what's normal and what isn't, of what cannot be questioned, etc., like those can lead people to do things that from other perspectives seem incoherent or not rational.
Yes.
Right? Another way to sum this up is that if you're born into a particular place and time, into a particular family and culture, and if these relationships that you have to authority and to what's normal are not given eternal, but rather normalized and constituted both then and in an ongoing way, which you replicate or chafe against over time, that means that one thing that the human does is that we have really remarkable capacities for ratifying the status quo of the world that we come into it.
Yeah.
And with identifying with power or writing our way into or around or through circumstances that do make us feel vulnerable or that activate vulnerable feelings.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that Adam Phillips, a lovely English psychoanalyst and writer, says about this topic is that we suffer primarily from symptoms of our effort to defend ourselves against suffering. That when we encounter those moments of longing, loss, fear of loss, vulnerability, dependence, we are prodigious, ingeniously gifted at creating means of avoiding the full brunt experience of our essential vulnerability and dependence and the marks of experiences of vulnerability and the dependence and suffering and trauma. We are so ingenious at avoiding those things. The symptoms that are created by that avoidance is what we tend to suffer from.
Yeah, and I think it's worth like just sticking with this for a second, because like so much of how we understand and how much of, like specifically like a liberal commentariat oftentimes frames problems of political understanding, whether as like a moral task of empathy or as a task of description, is posing questions like why are people voting against their own self-interest,
right?
Like the classic, like what's the matter with Kansas? Like why are people like here, if people were exclusively rational, then they would know that co-signing this policy will have environmental side effects that are terrible to them,
yes.
or they will be just giving money to like the 1% and impoverishing themselves, etc., right? Well, the problem here is false consciousness. They just need to know better. The answer is no. They're these are decisions that are being made for reasons that are not necessarily the same as economic rationality,
yes,
or like the rationality of class consciousness, but they are reasons that track to legible identifications, narratives, and feelings.
Right. Right.
Right.
Right.
So instead of just being about political economy and centering in the driver's seat of that, this kind of abstract subject,
yeah,
and these abstract market forces, we instead deal with libidinal economy, right? Which is the fancy word for like the collective and shared resources of fear, of fantasy, of desire, of shame,
yes,
of yearning, of images and stories that circulate in a cultural space. A lot of those things that seem to be people acting against their own self-interest either misunderstand what those people see as their self-interest,
right,
or neglect to understand the ways in which what's at stake is part of their selves and not narrowly the interest of, like, you know, what's on a given policy ballot.
Right, right. Yeah. I think one of the things that I learned from reading Freud is that we are never less rational. We never make less sense than when we try to give an account of ourselves. and so this is a huge problem for like the whole liberal concept of democracy and polling. Okay, we ask people these discrete questions about policy, then we make a judgment about why a particular political coalition functions the way it does, why a certain policy is popular or unpopular, with the built-in assumption that people can account for themselves, that they can account for their desires, they can account for what they want in the world in a way that comports with this concept of a rational subject who is not inevitably and in every instance bedeviled by this well of what people will call irrational instincts, desires, fantasies, fears that are essential to the multitudinous person that they are.
And the poll thing always kind of weirds me out too, because like whenever I get up, we live in Pennsylvania, battleground state, we always get these calls, and talk about overdetermination. All the questions are super overdetermined and full of cues, right? Are you willing to let CRT teachers be in the same school as York children,
yes,
right? Like, of course.
Should we be tough on the border?
Yeah, should we be tough on the border?
Should we be tough on crime?
Do we need a more muscular, like, foreign policy, or do we need, like, a super swole policy?
Do you love daddy or don't you?
That's exactly right. And so many of these questions are either like, they either activate the like, well, I'd like to sound like a person who knows what the fuck I'm talking about. So like, I'd like to sound like a person who has this belief. So you'll say that. Or it is essentially an appeal to certain sort of templates of identification. And I think what's key here is that a lot of discourses position themselves outside of this.
Yeah.
Right. This is the economic rationality thing.
Right.
Or it's the like the Lakoff and Johnson strict father versus permissive father thing. Right. Which you all are very familiar with. Right. Like the like conservatives want a certain type of patriarch who legislates.
Right.
And it's very hard and difficult versus, you know, the liberal dad who
it's permissive.
You know, Christopher Lash, yeah, like mocks, who like wants to be your best friend and not really be anything. Right. And but of course, like, how does that model explain someone like, oh, I don't know, like Donald Trump,
right?
Right. At the point at which like evangelical patriarchs are literally casting their lot with this guy who is like transgressive sexuality, like embodied and avowed. And it's, you know, of course, like people will like try and party. Well, the real issue here, the real like the what actually matters is this passage of theology that you need to read, or what
right.
actually matters is this little bit of like, you know, lobbying behind, or what Putin, that shadowy other, is tricking them to believe.
Yes.
But no, like what if actually all these models, whether they're single causal on these other forces, occult or not, or kind of flattened about like the either or, the strict or the permissive father,
right.
actually like departed from the assumption that, well, people both want authority and transgression. They like the having a patriarch who both is a moral monster but also moralizing is attractive to some people. That
yes.
that fulfills certain needs for them.
Right.
Racism is fundamentally irrational in certain communities where it's used to like perpetuate broader caste level class impoverishment, but also it gives a hit of pleasure to the people who see themselves as benefiting from it
right.
that may lead them to act against their material interest.
Right.
Right. And being able to like point to like, well, how it's not just about what these people say they want, but what this they're saying they want does.
Right.
Right. Or as you guys have asked, like, what are people giving themselves permission to do? It's so crucial, and it sidesteps either like correcting people or like excluding ourselves from that equation, because I think we can turn this on ourselves.
Yeah, we're being a little abstract. I promise that we're going to dive into some specific ways in which these concepts help us understand concrete political phenomena in a moment. One thing I'll say is that so there's a way in which this produces a kind of resignation, because you aren't going to be able to, in many instances, reason. Who says that? Reason someone out of something that they didn't arrive at out of reason. Is that a Swift?
Well, could be Swift, yeah.
Let's say it's Jonathan Swift. Something like, you can't reason someone out of a position that they did not arrive at via reason. So there's a sort of resignation that's involved in this, that like a lot of the ways in which we conceive of what the task of politics is becomes a lot harder if you take seriously what Pat is talking about here. The irrationality as a synecdoche for libidinal joys that one can derive from attaching themselves to one political idea instead of another, whether or not that cashes out in their economic or sociological or any kind of other interest. So there's a resignation there. But I think also for me, there's a humility and a kind of equanimity that I derive from this, which is, if you understand that people's attachments to the political ideas that they have is not always simply, I hate that person and that's who I am as a political subject. I've arrived at this opinion rationally. I'm rationally a racist. I am rationally a misogynist. That's also, in another way, a very depressing political landscape. So in the same way that, on the one hand, it can make you resign to the fact that you're not always going to be able to just talk someone into or get them to read the right studies from the Center for American Progress to convince them that they're voting against their material interests, you also get to understand that it provides a pathway to understanding that our political enemies are interpolated, determined, overdetermined in precisely the ways that we are. That the feelings that we have about the political beliefs that we have, the kind of like unnameable substance between who we are and what we believe, that substance is kind of the same, or at least it's homologous to the way that our political opponents experience their political beliefs. And for me, doing this podcast, that can be really helpful. Because if I run around in my life seeing that everybody who votes for Donald Trump is rationally decided, they thought really hard about it, and they decided that they prefer patriarchy, racism, hypercapitalism, and a strict hierarchy in which certain people experience pleasure and comfort at the expense of everyone else, and that was on the menu and they checked yes, that's more depressing in a way than encountering the reality that we're trying to shape here about the way that people relate to themselves and to the political life world. The second thing I want to say, to take us in further, one of the things that Pat is describing reminds me of something that he and I have talked about before, which is what I consider the hypocrisy versus symptom game. And basically that in American politics, and I think probably in other political communities too, hypocrisy has this analytical and moral weight. Constantly politicians are saying, well, you say that you care about this, but you do this. You evangelical Christians say that you care about Christian morality, but you vote for a serial misogynist and sexual deviant. And the hypocrisy is meant to be explanatory, sort of an unexplainable thing that should cash out into some kind of political benefit for the people who point it out. But one of the things that psychoanalysis has switched my brain onto is that almost always where there is a claim of, or I myself identify hypocrisy, I should think, is this hypocritical or is this symptomatic? And what that means is this hypocritical, meaning that these are irreconcilable beliefs, or is there some middle term? Is there something that connects these things that makes what appears to be incongruous, in fact, entirely congruous? And that's what Pat was pointing to when he said, Trump is the permissive father and the authoritarian father. That in fact, if we use psychoanalytic frameworks, we can almost always identify the way in which what appears to be opposite and irreconcilable beliefs, attachments, have some kind of relationship to each other, which is reliant in some way on their incongruity. That their incongruity is like part of why they make sense.
Yeah. And in fact, I think this in some ways can be tied back to the first thing that you were just saying, right? Which is like, well, what's one possible output of looking at things this way, right? And I think bracketing questions of empathy or anything, and I should say too, like, we're trying to understand how stuff works, not ratify it as good.
Yes.
Right? Because psychoanalytic thinking emerges from essentially a caregiving space, at least from a position where interpretation is quintessentially embodied in a clinical encounter, and that's, you know, hemmed in by a Hippocratic oath, right? There's already a certain strangely bracketed relationship to the moral.
Yes.
Right? And I should say too that, like, I'm not claiming that for ourselves, but I am saying that part of like what we need to be able to do is to think through how essentially odious thoughts and odious beliefs can coexist, right, and work together to ratify certain realities, right?
Yeah.
You see, like, what are the structures that underlie a whole way of looking at the world, and how can that maybe change or not? So, like, one, just to sort of bring this around granularly to the question of hypocrisy, right? Like, if on the one hand that gives that type of consciousness helps you understand the how or why what people do is a little more legible or makes sense, even if it's not rational.
Yes.
It also allows you or us to step to avoid the trap of doing the same thing over again, which is just thinking that pointing that out itself matters. Because, like, calling something a hypocrisy is very interesting as a gesture, because it sort of, on the one hand, it establishes the person who's calling it out as having better perspective and a moral judgment, but also it really puts, it's like putting the burden supposedly on the hypocrite to, like, resolve that contradiction, when in fact, no, the contradiction is how they live. The contradiction resolves problems for them.
Right, exactly, yes. The contradiction is the solution for them.
Yeah, exactly. And so here's like some examples of this one, right? Like, we can go back to one that psychoanalysts in the 20s and 30s are writing about at great length, and Freud himself did. Like, the stereotype of the wicked Jew, right? If you read, like, Der Stürmer, etc., like, you will see the coexistence or the rapid toggling between otherwise incoherent propositions, i.e. that the Jews are all Marxists and they're bomb throwing and they want to undo the concept of money and kill God.
Yeah.
So they're atheistic and antinomian levelers. But also in the next sentence, they can be simultaneously like the cult brothers of Zion who control the Rothschild family and the international monetary system.
Right.
And as a series of logical propositions, being all powerful in the realm of finance, but also wanting to destroy finance at the same time, is not coherent. But that's because it's not actually about the other. Like most stereotypes, or like all stereotypes, is more about the work that that stereotype does for explaining a series of feelings or projects or fantasies that the person articulating those stereotypes espouses or buys into.
Yeah. So in the case of 20th century anti-Semitism, what does that contradiction do for those who are bought into it, either as a political project or as just a kind of personal belief?
Having an other who they can both vanquish and eliminate, which offers them hope, but also an other who is powerful enough to explain how they're suffering during the Depression, and also that can explain the incoherent experience of the being stabbed in the back,
right?
The Dolsoffel agenda and like this national castration,
yes,
right? Having to blame your own or work through the international processes or deal with the supply chain crises that drove the fall of the Reich. That's a lot to ask of everyone, but everyone feels shame. Everyone feels there's trauma. Like, in some of this data is absurd in terms of like the amount of families that lose like male breadwinners or close male relatives. Like, you have like traumatized generations who are dealing with feelings of loss, dealing with feelings of betrayal, dealing with guilt from perpetration.
Yes.
Right? And so they weave together what actually Vavin Folkan, another analyst, calls a chosen trauma and a chosen glory, right? Like, this is, we could have been this one good thing, but then they took it from us. And again, the stereotypes don't make sense, but you can find this everywhere, right? Another quick example, if you read the memoirs or statements of slaveholders in the American South, antebellum or in the colonial period, how is it possible that the enslaved Africans whom they are quote-unquote overseeing can on the one hand be childlike innocents who need to be tended for in an extended family model and brought to Christ and are simple and safer under the whip versus also they're constantly scheming, devious killers who have to be kept in line and they're going to slit your throat every night?
Right.
How could they be both these things at once?
Right.
And the answer is, well, no, they're just people, but this isn't about them. This is about what the slaveholders want to do towards these people and how they want to justify their actions towards these people. And their entire perspective hinges on what for us would be, it's a hypocrisy, but again, it's set against the broader sin of, I don't know, like chattel slavery. Who gives a fuck about hypocrisy, right?
Well, yes, but it's a moment where when the slaveholder is giving an account of the other, the most other that they've ever encountered, the most other in their very intimate and not particularly large world of relations, they're really giving an account of themselves. When they give an account of the other, they're giving an account of themselves. And for them, it is necessary that their safety must be dependent on the unfreedom of the slave, the enslaved, because the enslaved will come and cut their throat in the middle of the night. They need to be beaten and forced into submission because there must be a moral justification for what they do to them. and they must feel that they play a moral paternalistic role at the same time. The institution itself is not just based on preventing them from getting their throats cut, but it must be also based on some kind of altruistic enterprise, which is what was the account of slavery by pro-slavery intellectuals in the South.
So the classic Samuel Johnson line, right? How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for freedom from the drivers of Negroes, or I think is the line, right? And it's well, who else would you be hearing it from?
Yes.
Like, of course, there's going to be all the louder precisely because it's from them,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I was looking up some quotes. I was reading Alan Taylor's American Revolution. Two lines from Patrick Henry describes slavery as repugnant to humanity as it is inconsistent with the Bible and destructive to liberty, yet is still wedded to the enterprise because of the general inconvenience of living without them.
Yes.
Right? And at least that's owning it.
Yeah, that's owning it a little bit more.
I think the important thing here is to understand that what the third party perceives as a hypocrisy is oftentimes just a quilting point or a keystone for how someone understands their own self-position and the reduplication of a way of life and
yes.
various political projects, right? And I was the third example that I was thinking of in light of this and in light of your excellent episode with Rihanna, the 5-4 podcast, right? Like, you very astutely laid out the gap between this protection of the abstract innocent
yeah.
of life in the womb versus the total immiseration and general disposability of mothers and those kids the moment they emerge from it.
Yes, where they do not deserve the protection of a robust social safety net or anything like that.
Exactly. They have no original sin until they pop out and then suddenly fuck them,
yeah.
right? It literally is like, let God sort them out. And again, the answer is not to extrapolate a series of propositions about innocence and then hold these people to it. How do you believe this, etc.? It's to look at the broader political context and the what that position allows them to accommodate.
Yeah,
it should make perfect sense that people will be invested in themselves as the arch defenders of innocence in the abstract, all the more so than anyone else.
Yeah.
Precisely because they're invested in maintaining a system that's actually about the control of women's bodies, that's actually about like widely distributing guilt and criminalization to people,
yep.
and otherwise about sort of imposing a type of social reproduction.
The particular kind of family.
Yeah. So it's in some ways like the contradiction is only a contradiction from the outside. Like here it's what people say to ratify what they've done afterwards.
Yeah.
The other example, I always like think of a police officer, right? Who's just menaced by somebody. And that person who was going to kill them, like all the, it can be many things at once. They could be like a child and animalistic, but also like, we're going to ambush you in some very sophisticated way. And yes, you had the gun, but the way they were moving at you made you suddenly have no power, even though you initiated the encounter and therefore it's self-defense, et cetera, right? These are post-facto narrative like tropes or topoi that are invoked to justify an outcome and an ongoing system of how
right.
power works.
And it's not, the thing about the police account is that it seems to be a chronological thing where the police must come up with a justification for it after the fact. And of course there is that in their minds. They do get together and figure out, well, let's say he had a gun, or let's say that glint from the refrigerator looked like a knife. But it's also happening already in real time. The authorization of the way of thinking about what they do as both dangerous, heroic, and necessary, that authorization, it overdetermines, it precedes the encounter and pervades it as well. So the post hoc justification is also a preemptive protection and a preemptive justification in many circumstances.
It's about maintaining those relationships, and it's an ongoing process of metabolizing and naturalizing a type of social order and political project that the person espousing those beliefs has an investment in, whether material or psychological, fantasy or improbable.
Well, before we move on from, because we were talking about, you know, the archetypal example of the enslaved and the slave owner, one thing I'm reminded of in the like loudest yelps for liberty line is that one of the things that I think actually sort of more of the liberal commentariat has identified is that when conservatives talk about the idea that white people are going to be a minority soon, they betray the fact in their desperate, catastrophic fear of this outcome that they know what they expect to happen is for them to be treated the way that white people treated minorities throughout American history. And this is also something that I find very useful, if troubling, about thinking in a psychoanalytic way is the way that there is a historical inheritance of trauma. And it doesn't play out in the way of like one person is oppressed and then they oppress the other person, then they oppress the other person. It's actually so much more fucked up and complicated than that. But I do find that reading Freud, reading his later sort of anthropological works, thinking about the primal scene, thinking about an inherited trauma, how that could actually work. You know, yes, I mean, it's true that like the conservative is betraying a certain kind of knowledge, a certain kind of fear, when they acknowledge that their fear of becoming a minority is based on not necessarily their own participation, their own active participation in the oppression of non-whites, but some kind of inherited shame, guilt, enjoyment that they know is there.
Part of the way our discourse works, particularly in this moment where actual political, where like opportunities for actual political agency are made steadily less and less imaginable, and the substantive distance between the parties on a lot of levels sort of erodes.
Yes.
Right? Is that so much of what are taken to be political reckonings are just about, well, vibes, really, right? Yeah. Or about like fundamentally personal experiences of shame, fundamentally personal desires for recognition, etc., in lieu of any type of structural change. And some of that makes a lot of sense because like structural stuff, you know, like may not make you feel good. Hell, structural stuff may not make you feel anything at all, right? Like you may not get to see it in your lifetime. Whereas people feel like that the fate of statues is so self-relevant to them.
Yeah.
Right. Or that the latest columnist who they don't actually give a shit about, who certainly doesn't give a damn about them, maybe getting quote unquote canceled, is somehow they have some stake in that. Right.
Yeah.
And part of what's I think we're thinking about this here is that like a lot of these are petty, like silly debates. I'm not talking about the statues things like them, like, but like, but a lot of these like culture war things are essentially displaced symptoms for anxieties over a broadened sense of precarity in the present, much as looking backwards, a lot of these litigations about history are people metabolizing like their inability to reckon with their existing as individuals who came into being in a society that was defined by profound lack of equality.
Yeah.
And like, I think an actual politics of that would change this would bypass the individual concerns at all, would not make it about your feelings, right?
Yeah.
Like, but there is something like, even if we grant that the backlash against like quote unquote CRT is purely astroturfed, on some level, like people do on the one hand have to reconcile their own feelings of the traumas of their lives with the realities of historical traumas that they seem to be unwilling to ignore or that they find themselves less able to ignore. And that has to be dealt with somehow.
Yes.
And hypocrisy is just one of several defense mechanisms for, and a universal one, mind you, like this is liberals do this too in all kinds of ways. Like, I believe we should have great public schools, but I'm going to send my kids to such and such an academy because they're my kids.
Yeah, sure. I want most white kids to go to school with black kids, but not mine.
Exactly. And there's empirical data about this, about like the actual percentile of quote unquote non-white faces in a given neighborhood scene at which white gentrifiers feel that a place is diverse, right? And it's, you know, it's not, it's again, it's not rational. If they were purely rational beings and they were just doing a proportional count, then it would look very differently, but they're not. It's about vibes. It's about their sort of like inchoate expression of that. And I think that you have to start thinking about the, this is where like the material comes back in too, like thinking about the material circumstances and the imaginative resources that underwrite and make these types of political positions possible is the most important thing, right? And to realize that like people can be saying things that they don't necessarily believe while still believing part of it, or it's still being a type of truth for them.
Yeah.
And that's a really difficult thing to think through.
I mean, we're not saying, and I hope that it doesn't sound like we're saying, that people are attached to irrational, self-harming beliefs for no reason. They're attached to those beliefs because they do something for them. And they might do something for them in the very immediate that justifies their position in the social order, which benefits them on some more concrete level. It may be just a way of ceasing to experience the discomfort of feeling guilt, of being identified as in the wrong, or as selfish instead of altruistic, as cruel instead of kind. I mean, I sort of think about this in my own thinking as how Freud helps me with Marx and ideology, because like, yes, I think like the sort of vulgar account of ideology is that the ideas that rule in a society are those that perpetuate the particular power structure that exists already, and people buy into those ideas because of the material structures that pervade the system so that the people in power, the ruling ideas are the ideas of those who rule. But that doesn't account for, like, well, so why everybody else, not just the people at the top? And obviously there are Marxists who don't speak in a Freudian idiom who do help us understand this. But for me, just being like, well, people's attachment to ideology has this dimension that is rooted in their deepest fears, their most intimate shames, their most immediate desires. Well, if that's the case, yeah, well, I can understand how this all works, you know? So it's just to say that, like, it's not an account of false consciousness exactly, and it's not an apology for people who participate and perpetuate unjust systems. It's just a more textural account of how that all fucking works.
Yeah. That's spot on. I think another way to maybe, like, flesh out the stakes of this, right, is to think about, like, we are naturally drawn to narratives of very clear distinctions between good and bad, very hygienic operations, between the victim and the victimizer, etc. Yeah. Right? And of course, please let me stress this, there are spaces of adjudication and immediate political intervention,
yeah,
right, and events that unfold where someone clearly is a victim in this circumstance, and the character is clearly a victimizer, and this is different from talking about accountability, right?
Yeah.
But one thing that our discourse gets very difficult about, and that it's literally can cause, like, psychic pain for us to talk about, is what do you do when you love someone who also does bad things,
yeah,
to other people or to you, right?
Right.
What do you do about the fact that you have a relative who has odious beliefs, and maybe you've even cut them out of your life, but you still kind of love them because if they taught you how to be a person on some basic level, right? You, yeah, can't simply, like, file them over into, like, that column in your robot Excel spreadsheet and be like, dead to me. Because even if they're, you have to mourn dead people too, right?
And in fact, I mean, I know this from my own life, from people I love in my own life. When someone dies who is a family member who caused someone great suffering or abused them, there is a kind of deeply painful mourning that happens in many circumstances. It's not this good riddance, almost never. That in fact, the pain of what they've inflicted and the pain of the brokenness of the relationship is all the more acute when that person is gone.
I mean, the Freudian account of how mourning works is one of, like, the most, it's in Mourning and Melancholia as the little essay, and he's basically talking about why certain types of really severe depression resemble mourning of someone and how they're related and involves feelings, yeah, of anger and loss. But, like, to call back to, like, that initial thing where we're talking about how, like, people are made up of others, right? And where, yeah, the self is always relational and not necessarily rational. Like, the Freudian account of mourning makes a lot of sense. It's a really powerful one. It's basically just like that person who you just lost became a part of you through your relationship to them. And now, yeah, you have to deal with the emotionally fraught, cognitively tasking work of going about your life with an absence of a presence in the world while you still have the presence inside you. And you have to either, you can either get rid of that or work through it or pretend it's not there, but none of your options are great and the matter is painful, right?
Yes.
And so to extrapolate without doing any type of, like, exculpation, like, people are invested in not just the narratives of, like, I don't know, like, what they personally know someone to be like to them, right?
Yeah.
In ways that lead them to then defend them when they hurt other people in ways that are,
yes,
odious, right? But also, like, people are invested in a certain vision of what this country is, in what their parents supposedly achieved and earned, in,
yes,
what they did achieve and earn, in, like, what should be possible, in abstractions like the innocence of children or the sanctity of the family. And it's precisely because they're so invested in these things, because that's what we give people to invest in and that's what they have.
And because those things are a part of them.
Yes, that's who they are. It's literally who they are. So you have to develop mechanisms for accommodating both things in the world that threaten that, but also your own experiences of that do not comport with that idealization,
yes,
right?
Right?
And so you have to do things like, in some cases, these examples are really, are again, content warning for these because they're fucking terrible, but, like, there are lots of people who are abused as children who then go out and become abusers themselves. Now, this is not to in any way exculpate that behavior, right? But one account of thinking about this, thinking through, like, identification with the aggressor or certain types of traumatic sort of subjection, is that, like, someone who is hurt, particularly as a child, right, is taken advantage of in a moment of hyper-attenuated vulnerability, is taken advantage of by someone who they love, Yeah. Someone who they depend on, someone who is not always constantly abusing them, and thus they have to have a relationship to them, but also like they don't necessarily understand what's happening, but they feel terrible about it, and so they leave that situation feeling terrible with an ambivalent relationship to someone who they, you know, should have been there to protect them. And what do? Like, well, they begin to justify that person's behavior. They identify with them. They feel bad themselves, so maybe they did deserve it, or maybe they just feel so bad that now they have to go do it to someone else in order to feel that they're actually bad. Now they finally have proof that they're bad.
Yes,
right. And again, if people were robots, that wouldn't make sense, right? Yeah. It wouldn't make sense too that, like, to take another example, like, and this is something Sartre and French Psychoanalysts always talk about a lot. Like, if people were robots, right, then robots that did torture, right, like rational, then the ones, if you were a victim of torture, you wouldn't be doing torture later because you would know more than anyone. Yeah. Well, actually, no, like the experience of like the French paratroopers, like repressing the Algerian resistance, like a lot of those guys actually were tortured and then they went ahead and did it. Trauma provokes responses from people, provokes accommodations, provokes mechanisms for denying it, gainsaying it, putting on other people, mitigating it, etc. But that has real impacts in the world.
Well, to speak of a concrete example from right-wing politics at the moment, you and I have talked before about QAnon and about the obsession with the safety of children and sort of moral panics about children in general and how they have this particular relationship with the right, but that QAnon is a sort of especially one of these examples where the instinct is to do a hypocrisy thing and say, how could it be that Trump, a man who is associated very publicly with expressing sexual desires for his daughter, who is credibly accused of sexual assault in many circumstances, and who was good friends with Jeffrey Epstein, how could he be in the eyes of the QAnon conspiracy, the God King who is going to come and solve all of this and save all of the children? And that even as that becomes less and less plausible, there is still more and more and more justification for why it's already all in going on. He is doing, you know, what he was set here to do, save the children from rampant sexual abuse by, you know, the cloistered elite.
Just think about what a remarkable thing the human mind is to generate this. Right. Yeah. And groups of people working together, like what, like it's a confluence of needs and gestures and responses to anxiety and fear. Right. And it, which is not the same as exculpating. Right. I'm not making excuses for anyone here. But like what's striking about this, too, is it's like note always the fear is always of the stranger. It's of the other. Right. It's of the one outside the home who's trafficking children in Wayfair boxes, is Jeffrey Epstein, et cetera. And again, note how overdetermined this is, too. Right. This is whether it's like the anti-Semitism that's at play in some of that, or the fears about global commerce or whatever the hell. Right. It's symptomatic, but it's symptomatic not just of these pre-existing ideologies, but also of a desire to avoid recognition of the fact that, materially speaking, children are much more liable to be abused by the people in their own families.
Yes.
But like the point here, though, is that like that impulse to identify with authority gives comfort. That impulse to disavow proximate threats, right, to not deal with the way in which someone who could be close to you and who you may love might actually be the real threat.
Right.
Right. The way that you reconcile that is both by, you know, turning to authority, even if that authority is a perpetrator himself, but also by conjuring these sort of like evil others, like these strange strangers who are even more threatening than what these people are. And whether that translates into Rod Dreher writing, you know, 100,000 words about what trans people do in bathrooms, or Sourab Amari like doing casual transphobia as like a throwaway joke line, like.
Yeah.
These are pleasures that are being offered and identifications that are being offered as a way of compensating for pain that can't be acknowledged and for anxieties that are all too real.
Yeah, it was one of the light bulb things when I was playing the hypocrisy versus symptom game with myself over Trump and QAnon, where I thought, why would it make sense for Trump, the transgressive father, the one who talks about how hot his daughter is and who is a serial accused rapist, why would he be the figure who saves the day and is the protector? But of course, like the reality is when we acknowledge the fact that sexual abuse is overly represented in the family, the person who is your protector is also your abuser in that dynamic. And so it is not hypocritical, it is symptomatic that Trump could figure as both figures. in fact, it, like as you said before, the transgressive father and the permissive father, they're in productive tension, which helps people metabolize all kinds of experiences.
They exist in dynamic relationship, right? What, yeah. A more modern way of talking about psychoanalytic thought is it's psychodynamic thought. It's thinking about conflictual forces. And that's, I think, the key thing like to understand is that these forces are somewhat elemental, right? But also plastic in the sense that they don't have to be distributed in the same ways.
Yeah.
One could imagine politics that still give people outlets for their anger, but that don't do that through spectacular punishment or simply doubling down on the most vulnerable, right? What I think is part of the difficulty, and this is a personal emotional difficulty I have, right? But it is draining. It's very hard. Is realizing how many of these calls for others to suffer, which are calls for others to suffer that are unacceptable, that will do violence, that are the worst things, are also cries of profound pain.
Yeah.
And that's something that that's not me justifying the fantasies. It's not and note, like, the fact even I have an internal censor here that I'm invoking to do this indicates how much of our discourse, particularly on like the liberal thing, is about these sort of weird acts of invoking strong feelings, but not excusing them, or like invoking others, but maintaining some type of hygienic distance from them. Like Lacan, of all people, has this line about how like the people who aren't duped, the not duped, are the ones who err. And the idea there being like the ones who are like calling you out on like, oh, you're just a dupe, you're being a hypocrite. Like they think they're somehow out of that cycle, right? Yes. They're the ones. Whereas in some respects, like as with Patrick Henry earlier, or hell, as with some of these national conservatives on your previous episodes, like they're just saying the thing now.
Right.
That gap between the latent and the manifest is just there. And that doesn't make them right in the moral sense, but they're being certainly more parsimonious.
Well, let's, I think I can help with this because... Yes, when we encounter the calls by the far right, or just frankly, just the regular right, for certain kinds of people to suffer, to understand those as also calls, also expressions of pain, is very difficult for us on the liberal left, because in fact, what they want is so terrible, and as you keep saying, it's not exculpatory; it just might be true. But we are comfortable with saying that when Kyle Rittenhouse kills two people in the context of a racial justice protest. And it's even more severe, I think, in the past with white police officers who've killed black men and women, that there's a wave on Twitter of people saying, throw him in prison forever. If not, shoot him in the head. You know, when a white mass shooter gets arrested and the cops don't kill him, people go on and they say, if he was black, he'd be, you know, Swiss cheese right now. And there is an expression of desire for that to have happened. We on the left, we actually do understand that as an expression of pain, even if we are prison abolitionists and don't think that the state should be killing people extrajudicially, right? In that circumstance, we actually do understand. Now, again, these are not morally equal situations, but constraints of partisanship make it so we can see this in a certain light and not see it in another. And I know that you've thought deeply about Rittenhouse and also about the spectacles of these kinds of trials where one instance of violence is treated as sort of a synecdoche for the whole entire history of settler colonialism and anti-black violence. And then we are sort of our aperture of moral and political vision becomes so narrowed upon this one moment and we can't think beyond it. But I guess I feel like I need to reiterate that like it is not the same when a white conservative politician says, shoot migrants at the border, it is not the same thing as when black activists say, throw Darren Wilson in prison and throw away the key, right? But because we can experience expressions of desire of suffering in the other as an expression of pain in one circumstance, it suggests that we might be able to in others.
Much as we are, by virtue of being born into places and time, we are interpolated into family systems and cultural logics and processes of gender norming and racialization, all that stuff, sure. Like, it's also the case that we're, like, born in a certain type of relationship to a status quo.
Yeah.
In relation to a horizon of what's imaginable, right? To the confines of the given, right? I think that that's a libidinal attachment. That's not just an abstract given. And I think it, and this is a way for us, I think, to understand some of the stuff we're talking about in terms of historical trauma, right? Like the institution of mass incarceration is a death machine and a factory for trauma,
Yeah.
Right? That in its broader integration of the prison industrial complex basically responds after the fact to traumatic violence while also making traumatic violence much more likely.
Yes.
Right? And essentially tells people that what they're going to get for their suffering, the best that they can hope for, is more punishment for someone. Right?
Yeah.
You know, we can historicize that further and tie that into an entire racial capitalist project of social control. And that history is what it is. And those visions of what are possible are so pervasive and reduplicated everywhere that I don't pretend that I, like, there are definitely people who I would, you know, I derive the pleasure from the idea of their suffering. Like, Freud himself has this line quoting Heine, right? The German poet, love to forgive my enemies after they've been hung, right? Like, when you see someone being hurt or suffering, whether you identify with them or not, like, but particularly if you do, you want to reach towards what's available as a recourse, right? And when the horizon is constituted by this tightened imaginative foreclosure and these very cruel policy prescriptions, but also just this constant recirculation of negative affects, you're like, well, at least the wrong system works right once, right?
Yes.
At least evil life can be lived rightly when it comes to this one particular evil person, right? And and the thing is, I can't tell anyone what to do or think or believe at this point, but like, I do think that at least perceiving that's a trap of sorts, not denying that in yourself, right? Yeah. Not sublimating that into like some abstract, like technocratic language of correction or some bullshit like that, but also like not preventing yourself from considering what justice might look like just because you have negative feelings about it. Like, none of those things should be disqualifying, right? You should be able to feel ambivalent about institutions and people, but like, to feel complicated ways is not a hypocrisy. Hypocrisy doesn't disqualify you from politics. If anything, hypocrisy is the essence of politics, and litigating the boundaries of that and also shaping the institutions and shared imaginaries that make those hypocrisies possible, that's the political task.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so Pat, a few times you've mentioned this concept of the chosen trauma and the chosen glory. I've heard you talk about this before, and I think it's extremely helpful. So would you define that schema and then give us a few examples of how it works?
So just let me stipulate, to talk about a this is a technical term. It's not like a trauma that someone chose like to have happen to them. This is different from that defense mechanism thing we were talking about earlier, where someone like rationalizes being powerless by being like, actually, I wanted this.
Right.
That's different. The chosen trauma is understood as a touchstone historical event that in some ways establishes chosenness for a people, or that at the very least becomes a touchstone for group identification going forward.
Mm-hmm.
People define themselves as a people by reference to a singular historical event, which is a historical event that's understood to be incomparable to any other events that similarly may have happened to yet other people, and remains as a principle of differentiating going forward. So, for example, I don't know, if you were a Kosovo Serb, right? The idea, the Battle of Kosovo Polje, right? Like, how exactly a battle 600 years ago immediately tracks on to you, the fact that you're carrying an assault rifle, you know, in outside like Pristina or something in the 90s is a little, you know, it doesn't seem quite rational, right, in some sense. But if we do understand the identity of being this particular type of Serbian, it hinges upon this one historical moment and it's also a moment of glory, right? It was a defeat that was also the high watermark of a certain civilizational moment.
Right.
And the glory is like the thing that the trauma takes from you, right? Or it's the golden age that this one terrible event then changed everything around. The two can be somewhat separated, but conceptually they're linked, right? So you could argue, for example, like, why was 9/11 such a big deal? Well, it was a perfect chosen trauma. Like, everything changed on 9/11, right? Like, no other nation had their own 9/11, and in fact, we're going to count everything else that happened to this nation in terms of 9/11,
right?
Or when I think about some of the readings you've done of these various conservative thinkers who glorify this, like, Fordist Mayberry that never existed, like, that's the glory. That's the moment of glory, right? That we could just have back if it hadn't been traumatically ripped away by this event that defines us, right?
Which is like the sexual revolution, the new
The sexual left. Revolution, right? Yeah. Some sort of change that came from the outside, or that a betrayal from within, and this is the thing, that there's always someone else who took that from you. You are defined by your group participation in being traumatized, and there are enemies as a result from this, and wouldn't you know it, this regularly maps out into a later subsequent enactment of inflicting some variation of that trauma on those people as a kind of revenge or as a way to get back that glory.
Or some people, not necessarily the people who inflicted on you.
Yeah. It's going to be something because there aren't like Ottoman Turks around anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Like, but there are your Albanian neighbors.
Yeah.
Right. This is particularly the case, I think, in a lot of settler societies where certain types of, whether it be like, I don't know, like if you were to ask like actual numbers, the actual number of Tejanos and Mexicans and indigenous people who were killed by white settlers screaming, "Remember the Alamo," over the course of, 150 years since the Alamo, God even knows, right? But like, yeah. The scale wouldn't be, would
Texas Rangers and.
Yeah, and like military and settlers. Yeah. Like, there's no, like, but that's the trauma. You did this. This is now why we're going to take it out on you. It's a major orienting feature of how a lot of people understand political events, because if you question their righteousness, then they invoke that trauma, right? Well, you couldn't possibly know because you weren't one of us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And if you're in that group and you have a different view on this matter, then you're not really one of us.
Yeah.
In fact, you may be, and this is again one of those things that logically wouldn't make sense, but makes the sense of this type of like thinking. Not only are you disavowing who you are, you're siding with the people who did that with us, to us, right?
Yes,
you're the betrayer.
Well, sorry for my parochialism as a non-Zionist Jew, but it really does. It's just, I mean, I've been anti-Zionist since I was 18 or 19 years old, and exactly what you're describing is my encounter with the Jewish establishment in America. With liberal Zionist groups on my college campus when I was there. And it's precisely this, when you push and you push, they say, well, think about what they did to us. And I can't even disavow that, you know, they did that to my family too. They being Nazi Germany, not Palestinians. But that's the move that is generated by the chosen trauma, chosen glory. Again, it's almost too glib and straightforward, but is it hypocritical that Israel was founded as a settler colonial state and whose maintenance today depends on violent unfreedom of a people? In certain circumstances, concentration camp-like conditions in Gaza, is it hypocritical or is it symptomatic? And my answer would be symptomatic, but even saying that now on this podcast is going to produce exactly the reaction that you describe, which is not only am I not really a Jew, but I am siding with not just Palestine, but Nazis.
It produces these dynamics of like subsequent identification where these affects are tapped and these things like projective identification happen and people start acting out or even adopting the postures that are associated with like,
yeah,
it's a really bad dialectic.
Well, recall that, you know, early Zionists described the diasporic Jew in precisely the same terms in which Nazis described the diasporic Jew, this sickly, rootless character who has no national identity, who is impotent and weak, but dangerous. There are cartoons of this, right, that were produced, Ellie Valley, his Diaspora Boy cartoon is about this, and you can see that, in fact, it's very difficult to distinguish between certain kinds of pro-Zionist propaganda against diasporic Jews, which is to say people like me, and the idea of the new Israeli man who is strong, who is dominant, who is rooted, who is less intellectual, more visceral and vital. Is that hypocritical or is it symptomatic? I'll tell you my opinion.
We can domesticize this too for the states in a stateside way too, right? In the sense that like, look, let's grant that like origins don't determine everything. I think there's a kind of simplistic thing that happens sometimes where people are like, well, like just because the founding fathers were bad doesn't mean that America was bad. And it's like, okay, as though like,
that's the only,
the question of their badness or the state's badness is like something that's going to, like there's a concrete outcome that's going to come out of any conversation which we have this, right?
Yes.
No, I mean, like we're not going to like dig up George Washington and piss in his mouth, and we're not going to like,
speak for yourself, Pat.
Yeah, right. It's, we're not going to like, I don't know, like what any individual has to say about whether or not they think quote unquote Israel has a right to exist is not going to affect it, like its presence on a map, right? Like these,
yes,
are, but what people are being tested on actually is precisely this, that linkage of, well, don't you have an affective attachment to the, yeah, status quo and to the logics of authority that we supposedly should share, given our participation, you know, as being touched by this shared trauma.
Yeah.
And like, but like, it's interesting to think about this from the U.S. perspective, because like, yeah, I'm sure, you know, you can make critiques of the 1619 Project about how it erases indigenous history, etc. Like, there are all these things, but like, most of the time people don't even read the thing. And even if, let's say, that some of them were critiquing it because they feel that it overprivileges Origins, a lot of those same people kind of are also still into the ongoing maintenance of, like, a white minority rule state. Who knows how they would behave if, like, the 13th Amendment came up on the ballot again, right? Yeah. Like, so what I'm saying here is, like, that investment in preserving a glorious past in and of itself may be very common and universal, but when it's wedded to an ongoing realization of the present that very much resembles the lie that his glorious past obscures, then you know you're dealing with something really dark and bad.
And that's when it requires an enormous amount of discourse and vitriol to maintain. A protesting too much, you might say.
And also of, like, trolling to give people to this is the projective identification thing, it's a technical term from Klein, but, like, one way to understand that is that you do stuff that basically predisposes other people to act in a certain, like, emotional way, like you put your feelings in them and approve certain things, right?
Right.
So just to give a very specific example here, Rich Lowry's book contains genocide denial.
Rich Lowry, who's the editor of National Review.
And this book was promoted by the president, the then president Donald Trump at the time, who clearly read it very closely. I'm going to give you two graphs here, right? The key thing to know about the conquest of California when it eventually came about in earnest in 1846 to 1847 is that there was not much conquering to speak of. The province was lightly populated and barely governed. Few from Mexico settled there. At one point, the Mexican government sent convicts to try and populate the place, and soldiers stationed in the province were often drawn from jails. In 1835, the Mexican army had a little more than 300 men in California. As of 1842, the company stationed in San Diego had all of 14 unarmed men. Okay, and then here's a second graph. The ultimate disposition reflected the popular will of Texans, comparing this to the Texas situation, whereas there was basically no one in California to have popular will, although the establishment of Republican government and statehood quickly ensued. Right? The people living in these and other territories transferred at the end of the war got political stability, democracy, the rule of law, and a prosperous economic system. Now, I would recommend people check out the award-winning historian Benjamin Madley's book, An American Genocide, right? Which essentially describes how, I'm going to read here from Walter Hickson's survey histories. Mm-hmm. This is just the quick data here, right? Preceding the dispossession of the Plains tribes was a genocidal campaign against the California Indians. In a recent study, Benjamin Madley found evidence of hundreds of massacres and mass killings perpetrated against California Indians constituting an American genocide. That's his term, and he takes it through the legal paces. As a result of the gold rush, settlers poured into California too fast for the federal government and its treaty-making prerogative to gain traction. Thus, Americans dealt with California much like the settlers in Australia, treating the territory as terra nullius, empty or uninhabited land. By the time the federal agents arrived, surveyed the situation, and drew up the treaties to dispossess bands in a civilized, legal fashion, it was already too late. Here's the numbers. The Indian population of California, when the Spanish first built their missions on the Pacific coast, was estimated to be 300,000, which had been halved by the time of the 1849 gold rush. This is the period Lowry is talking about, where it was sparsely populated and there was no one to have a popular will. Yeah. Over the next decade, it plummeted another 80% to around 30,000 Indians as a result of murder, disease, famine, and declining birth rates. By 1900, only about 15,000 Indians remained. So just that's 120,000 people liquidated en masse, oftentimes using weapons issued by the then governor, drilled into action as militia constituted under California law with the explicit purpose of, in the words of at least one governor in several newspapers, race war.
Mm-hmm.
That Lowry, in his best-selling book, just completely invisibilizes.
Yeah.
I've sent notes about this to him multiple times and to people who cite it multiple times. They ignore it, or they'll sell it with a link to buy more, because if I'm angry, he must be right.
Yeah.
And I know that this is not my personal issue here, but just I want us to think for 1 second about what the fuck passes for normal versus pathological in a situation in which a paean to nationalism, to the beauty of the American project, can casually do genocide denial with no consequences for anyone doing it.
Right. Right.
And to me, like, I don't know. Like, that says that we, our discourse and what passes for being reasonable and polite has a really good capacity for metabolizing mass death. And you know, you didn't need COVID for that to come along either.
You know that Ernest Renan, the quote, "The acts of forgetting, as much as collective memory, are necessary for the creation of a nation." I think about that all the time. I mean, I think that ingenious, elaborate, collective efforts, which involve lots of institutions and lots of people, individuals and lots of power structures, are invested in forgetting certain sorts of things in order to effectuate exactly the sorts of things we're talking about here, which is some kind of stasis, which would be intolerable otherwise.
It's worth saying here too, like, I think that it's not a coincidence that the people for whom genocide denial is a casual paragraph are also people who take any attempt to interrogate, whether in the 1619 Project or otherwise, the mere idea of thinking about race in a systematic way as it bears on law, yeah, that they take that as an existential threat to the United States as it currently exists. The amount of psychic work, willful or otherwise, to disavow monstrosity,
right,
requires a compensatory outlet. And that is resolved by making the people who make you feel bad about that thing,
yeah,
or who dare to suggest that that thing even exists, the ones who actually want to do, like, white genocide.
Right.
It's a reaction formation. They're the ones, right, like, they're the ones who are going to destroy you.
Right.
When I think about, like, the National Conservatives Conference that you guys, you know, covered, like, these constant appeals to, like, well, we're standing on the prefaces, we're going to be destroyed. Like, on the, yeah, one hand, like, I think they're giving themselves, as though they needed it, permission to do whatever they want, but also that's expressing their acute sense of being under attack to the extent to which these constitutive contradictions that undergird their worldview are patently ludicrous.
Yeah.
And involve monstrous contortions.
Yeah, immorality on a world historic scale. The notion of it being comparable to little Jimmy getting upset because someone talked about slavery in the classroom is monstrous in its incompatibility.
You can both feel the wounds to amour propre and the anxiety and also the reveling in the cruelty of it. And you can also feel the broader, like the personal cruelty and the personal bonds of bonding with people against looking at those people who are hurt by this, right? Like,
yeah,
it once it's there, it's obvious, you can't deny it. But you can also feel the broader erasure of things that are politically possible, right? Mm. Where it's like those people who we did this to are still the same people that we did it to. That's why we've got to keep doing it to them, because they'll just do the same thing to us.
Yeah.
Right? It's a total flattening of temporality. And I don't think the liberal answer, which is, well, just feel really bad about that.
Yeah.
Right? You should just personally feel bad about that. Well, no, this is not about personal feelings.
Yeah,
right?
It's not going to help.
It's got to be something else. It's much in the same way as, like, Lowry and all these other conservative commentators who we've talked about this before, right? But, like, from Dreher to others are constantly being apostrophized by liberal commentators as representing something intelligent, representing, like, this is the real tradition. These people are carrying the torch. They're erudite. They're feeling, etc. And then a year later, they just, you know, they go fully,
yeah,
you know, they go fully out there, and then suddenly they're sort of they're forgotten, right? But like, what if that thing that they were peddling was always there? Right? And what if what liberals want to hear is the pretense that they don't have to look at that, like, erased thing too?
Oh, I think that's right. Maybe I'll just read this to you. This is from a piece I wrote about CRT, a critical race theory that hasn't come out yet, but it's about precisely this. The conservative fear is that the liberal, tormented by guilt, will throw away the accumulated inheritance of Western civilization in a fit of historical self-abnegation, cast it all at the feet of the oppressed in a final bid for redemption, one that might finally free them from the burden of history. In the past, the conservative conceived of himself as the adult in the room, the stern father willing to resist the childish guilt of the liberal and the childish vengefulness of the untutored racial other. He alone is willing to speak the truth out loud. We have the power. It was given to us, and we're not giving it up. Without the vigilant oversight of the conservative movement, this reasoning went. The, quote, minority mobs will destroy the country, and the liberals will let them. But conservatives are no longer willing to embrace their traditional role in this hideous family romance. They now aspire to moral innocence too. Only where the liberal wants absolution, the conservative wants freedom from ever being accused. Both are varieties of evasion, refocusing all conversation on the alibi rather than the crime. In the face of American history, white elites are two suspects who can't get their story straight.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Like, I'm struck by, too, like, how much, like, talk about an overestimation of what the Joe Biden agenda actually is.
Yeah.
Right? Right? Like, we're not, like, there's a whole psychoanalytic thing we can get into about reparation and recognition and slippage between these three. But, like, even if there were, like, the worst realization of, like, these liberal fantasies, it's not going to be people giving away, like, all their basic assets.
No.
I just don't see that happening. It's going to be more like a lot of uncomfortable HR sessions with books by Robin D'Angelo. Right, like that's the threat somehow. But again, it's that has to be invoked as a threat because on some level, I think the liberal self-indulgent guilt, which goes nowhere, exists in a kind of folie à deux or perverse like tango with the self-licensing cruelty for its own sake. And those two things work together dialectically to perpetuate a certain basic system. And I'm thinking here now of like what Freud, Dreyer, an anthropologist, calls the narcissism of small differences. Like, as functionally speaking, the differences between the parties gets less and less, at least as far as a lot of policy are concerned, the insistence that actually the only thing that matters, right, is the difference between the parties. It's amplified.
This is, if listeners have listened to the last episode on the National Conservative Conference, this is a version of what Matt requested be called the Sitman Principle, which as the differences between the party become less and less significant, culture war shit becomes more and more deranged. He's going to be so pissed that Freud got to it first.
It's also, we could see this also too in like the response to January 6th, right? Here are some, like a whole lot of liberals have been like, here's the chosen trauma. You will never know what it was like to be a security guard or a Senate or Nancy fucking Pelosi on January 6th and the entire nation stands or falls on this.
Yeah.
And you know, this is one of those rare moments where also the right can view that as a chosen trauma because you will never know what went through Ashley Babbitt's head. Therefore, we had this perfectly convergent theatrical pairing of the permissive and the transgressive or various combinations of it. Well, meanwhile, you know, gerrymandering proceeds apace and the plague still rages.
Yes, right? Exactly.
Roger Bellin on Twitter, you know, it seemed like has described the Democratic Party as a series of elaborate defense mechanisms for the American bourgeoisie. And there are times when that hits real hard. And I think this is one of those.
It hits harder and harder. I mean, the Russiagate was the same thing. It was like, it was such a disavowal of the real political circumstances of the Trump presidency that almost every hour of network liberal TV was dedicated to this controversy, to this completely displaced conflict over the idea in a glib way that Trump was not American, that the Trump phenomenon was in fact precisely the product of chicanery from abroad and not deeply rooted in the traditions of this country and its political traditions and even the liberal tradition. To say that it was symptomatic is an understatement.
And with the toolkit we've unpacked here, right? Like, I think you can look at some of the symptoms, the sequelae to that, right? As being demonstrative of what we're talking about, right? Whether it be people who literally one minute were talking about how the FBI was incorrigibly Trumpist and was never and helped give Trump the presidency, but also now the FBI is good because check out Robert Mueller, right? Or even just in the past couple of weeks, people like condemning the system that accommodated Rittenhouse so much, right? Yeah. And then right before the verdict drops, they're like, now I want to watch Paul Manafort get perp walked, right?
Yeah.
Suddenly the law enforcement is good. And the point here is, much as the state of Israel is going to exist, whether or not random motherfucker says something about it, like the FBI doesn't need you to identify with it.
Yes.
Like, you don't, or rather, you don't have to. Now, maybe the project of like, you know, what Byung Chul Han calls like psychopolitics in our neoliberal era involves you having to identify with it, involves you having to personally identify with Dr. Fauci.
Or that's the only outlet for what politics as such is.
And that's how you know you matter, because you piss someone else off doing it.
Yeah.
That's also why everyone who complains about being canceled, half of them just want to be canceled because that means they'll matter for a little bit.
Right.
These kids, they're going to live so much longer than me. The least decency they can do is to cancel me.
Yes.
Because then I will have mattered and I'll have gotten the kids hot and bothered.
It's like the idea of like the, you know, 65-year-old Trump guy on Facebook who posts like, I'm sure going to get canceled for this. And it's like five likes, maybe like one angry symbol from his, you know, 18-year-old granddaughter. You know, one thing that Matt and I talk about on the podcast a lot is how neither a vulgar Marxism or a vulgar Freudianism is sufficient. It's often better than most of what's on offer. when you're casting about to make sense of something, even the vulgar forms of these extraordinarily useful bodies of knowledge can lead you in the right direction.
Yeah, like there's always resistance to Freud, right? And some of it takes a tack that we've sort of already spoken about like blaming people who bring up a problem as creating the problem, right? There are lots, much in the same way as the QAnon people are on the hunt for child predators anywhere except they are to be found, right? There were plenty of people who responded to Freud's like first talking about childhood sexual trauma and then producing a variety of theoretical elaborations and developments on that as actually sexualizing children, right? So so that there's the protective mechanism for innocence and stuff.
Even Freud, we could say, I mean, there's a lot of controversy in the record about this, but there's an argument he made that Freud discovered pervasive sexual violence in the family in the Viennese bourgeoisie, and knew on some level, conscious and unconscious, that saying, this is what I've discovered in participating in this talking cure with my patients, would destroy him and destroy his research, because no one would accept the reality that sexual violence is pervasive in the family, literal sexual violence is pervasive in the family. And so instead, it became the realm of fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a compelling critique too. Like, this gets into those dynamics we were talking about earlier, right? Where it's like even the possibility of abuse by someone who you love, like the fact of vulnerability, right? The fact of being attracted to someone who could hurt you. Like, these are difficult things that people have to work through. And how they choose to do it can really set them on certain pathways or produce mimetic repetitions of it.
Right.
And I guess, like, on the topic of, like, vulgar Freudianism, like, the one thing, like, doing the work I do about, like, you know, the other stuff I do, like the applied stuff about masculinity and fragile sort of like gendered formations and gun control and stuff, I will always say, like, no, guns are not just penises. Guns are not just penises. Guns are not just penises. That's silly. Yeah. That's absurd, right? However, I defy anyone to write something publicly that can be misread or read as being about gun control and to not get mail from people who really test the limits of reticence vis-a-vis phallic interpretations of stuff. And by which I mean, like, this gets back to, like, this is a graphic example, but I'm gonna be frank with you about it. Sometimes you will say something or write something about guns, which are such a sine qua non, like, quilting point or prosthetic identification for a synecdoche for so many other things. And what you get are people, and I'm not making this up, and other people will get this too, people are like, how dare you think my gender is tied up in my guns? That's absurd. You're a pervert. And then seamlessly pivoting to an extended paragraph, and I've gotten a lot of these, where they describe how much they want to see me get sexually violated by the usual suspects who penetrate my home, take guns I have from me, and then inflict graphically descripted sexual violence on me and the people I love.
Yeah.
And that's just part of the job I do. It's shitty to get this. But on some level, sometimes the cigars are just cigars, but sometimes there's that overdetermination. It really, what you think is there. And it's there on a really brutal and ugly level. And pretending that it's not there in search of, like, some way to, like, redeem those people, it seems misguided.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of, like, I think to end this on a note that ties into the earlier conversations about, like, abortion rights or other things, like, there is some point at which I think the, like, well, how could they possibly think this? And how, if only we could better explain to them how what they're thinking is incorrect, is a way of refusing to confront the fact that what's at stake for some people, very straightforwardly, and they own this, is inflicting violence. Right. Yeah. Is ratifying state violence, paramilitary violence, sexual violence, all kinds of really horrible stuff.
Yeah. But what's at stake is their stories that tell themselves that allow them to do that. But what the example that you're describing points to is that the affective stakes of that is you want to cut off my dick.
Yes. Yes.
So it's simultaneously, it's extremely, like, take seriously what these people want, specifically because what it is that they imagine the alternative is literally castration. So it's not exculpatory. It's take very seriously this threat. Understand the just how existential it feels, because what you're describing is that it's not like, oh, I like to say racist stuff online. It's, if I don't get to say racist stuff online, if I don't get to participate in a project of, like, colonial refoundation, you want to cut off my dick.
Yeah, or it is as though you were you were putting that feeling on me. I'm so anxious yes. about my masculinity that, and I think that's like what's so striking about the like discursive apparatuses that we have, and what I really appreciate about the work you guys are doing in terms of reading these conservative thinkers and talking with them, like is taking people at their word in full context yeah. and taking them seriously. And right now, yeah. I think the psychoanalytic perspective involves like listening to them when their words betray themselves.
Yeah.
But also sometimes that means that people say what they mean sometimes.
They
and
really,
we really
do
need to trust them. And we don't know better because like, well, we put it more artfully, and we don't want to offend people who identify with this position but don't have the gumption to fully say it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, none of this is personal, right? On the level of, well, of course, it's personal in the sense I'm terrified, right? I definitely yeah. had one back and forth with one of these people that ended with him being like, you don't understand, all bold, I am not afraid of killing people. I'm like, okay, now I understand. All the things that were like, were actually I thought were a conversation were like, flowed from this, what was for a conclusion to me, but was a premise for him,
yes.
right?
Yes.
But the thing of it is like, too, is that when it comes to like thinking about how people are tethered to like imagining that instead of actual, like the actual people in front of them they have to deal with in terms of political stuff, they would much rather deal with projected versions of what they themselves would be saying in those circumstances.
Yes.
Right? Or that they can only engage in politics against people who are quote unquote serious, that is people who speak a certain argo yeah. back to them. That these are all dead ends. Or rather, not just that, that is a type of compatibility in perpetuating this basic system.
Yeah.
And again, it's not about the people, right? Like, for example, like I don't know what the hell like Rod Dreher's personal sexual peccadilloes are,
yeah.
but what matters is that he gets off in print talking about trans people and violence the way he does.
Yeah.
That type of coexistence of piety with just rabid cruelty.
Yeah.
Like, the job is not to be like, well, he's a hypocrite, or to do like this liberal thing where like, well, actually, but he's very beautiful when he doesn't want to kill people who are yeah. disposable to me. The point is just like, no, this is pure perversion. Like, what's being expressed and the ways being expressed are yeah. equally unacceptable.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the problem.
Yeah, right. So to close out, as we've described all of our enemies as perverts, but ourselves as perverts as well, let us not forget. We're recording this on the Saturday after Thanksgiving, and Pat and I have talked about this before, but the Thanksgiving meal is a very useful symbol for a very important Freudian concept, which will reveal something, and hopefully it'll draw this whole thing together about America and Freud and politics. And what I'm doing is setting up Pat for one of my favorite of his bits. But please, Pat, tell us about the Thanksgiving meal as a totemic feast.
So the first thing you need to know is that Freud, who is a rigorously anti-clerical thinker and who had some real problems with what he took to be the false pieties of universality that underwrite religion, Christian religiosity, right, and the ideas of sacrifice, etc. You know, he famously described the idea of loving one's neighbor as oneself as being perverse and incoherent, which I kind of agree with. But his theory of the origin of religion, and specifically Christianity, but he draws on a template that he assigns to other religions, is one in which an originary horde, as it were, of which in the German is more like a pack, like it's a group of a troop of monkeys of like early hominids, are lorded over by a silverback mature patriarch who disposes of resources and the right to reproduce in ways that are extremely selfish, and that and also entail his killing the young men so they compete with him. And like there's some interesting research by primatologists and anthropologists about this story, and you know what it does or doesn't say. It's true.
We're talking about an alpha male at the apex of a horde of pre-human or prehistoric humans, where this primal father of this horde kills or casts out his sons in order to enjoy exclusive sexual access to his daughters.
It's basically the originary patriarch as transgressive sex ghoul,
yeah,
and also doing primitive accumulation and killing the young, right? And in the Freudian meta-narrative for this, which is sort of a fable, right? So it tells a truth independent of that. The young males get together, the brethren, and they come up with a way to kill him with a weapon or communication or whatever, but they finally kill dad. They overthrow dad. And now they're left with a problem. One, that they have to produce a new social order, and one in which all of them, the only template they have is to be a primal, transgressive sex monster, primitive accumulation guy. And also they kind of loved him.
Yeah.
They realize that they miss him now that he's gone, right? They have ambivalent feelings, right? So they have an agreement in which they basically codify a new distribution of resources, establish themselves as equals, and then re-narrate their doing a murder as actually an act of generous sacrifice and giving on the part of the person whom the father whom they killed.
Well, importantly, in the Freudian story, they kill and eat the father.
Yes, they kill and eat him. He's consumed. He's consumed. It's like Dionysus or Cronos. That's on a bunch of different myths, but like Cronos, the castrating dad, right, who eats his own sons. They cut him up and they eat him, right? There's cannibalism here. That also further underwrites the Eucharistic stuff, right? Because like literally...
I just wanted to make sure we got to the Eucharistic stuff just so we could maximally scandalize Matt for when he listens to this.
So they have a feast that celebrates this, and Freud draws on this kind of 19th century anthropology, talk about totemism and the way in which an animal stands in for the person that they killed, etc., and for the principle of group cohesion, etc. This all may sound very far-fetched, like it has no traction anywhere, but as the psychoanalyst from Philadelphia, Lawrence Blum, has argued, there's a very famous pact between primal brethren, which involves the justification for killing the father and then appealing to brothers and redivining resources, and that's the Declaration of Independence. I strongly encourage, if you're not familiar with it, it's a notable text that involves outlining all the things that the king did and all the ways that he would hold back the population of the land, i.e. access to basic people behind social reproduction, and how he had to be overthrown, but now everyone is equal and they'll honor his passing. So that's one of the first ones, and we honor that in a variety of ritual meals. But also when it comes to Thanksgiving, which is quintessentially this event where we, you know, imagine family members to get angry at or get angry at actual family members, talk about a ritual meal that is a story of supposed plenitude and sharing at a founding American experience, but which is actually, you know, the quite rightly described as a national day of mourning by indigenous peoples, and is a story actually of taking things, right? But which then becomes a story of gratitude and sharing and togetherness. But no, it's about a beachhead of settler colonization by of Puritan freaks, right? That's not like we've reworked that into this delicious thing that somehow becomes a touchstone for whether or not like you're appreciative enough,
right?
And of course, you know, then you go off and watch people give each other TBIs, or you go give someone a TBI at Black Friday, right? So it really is the latent manifest thing is much thinner. But the third thing I wanted to say about this, and this goes back to like the utility of this as a myth, right? Like a lot of Freud's, if you're going to read Freud, I want to recommend people read Freud, you're going to come across stuff that's going to be just bonkers. These weird lines that are like, these weird stories, like, is this a metaphor? Is this a myth? Does he actually believe this? Is he like, is this as if, etc.? But I will say that the idea of like a patriarchal murder father who like is imposing sadistic rules of sexual access and disposing of people, vulnerable people, as property, and seems more interested in primitive accumulation than, I don't know, like his own survival or the perpetuation of his children. I mean, there's a certain number of privately owned companies that are, you know, family affairs that are effectively like that are responsible for a disproportionate amount of pollution on this planet. And you don't have to get far-fetched into like the transhumanist philosophies of Jeffrey Epstein, who wanted his dick frozen, right? Or Jeff Bezos and all the other people who like want to live forever. But the idea of politics and equality being haunted by the originary presence of transgressive, primitive, accumulating patriarchs who don't give a fuck about people and want to destroy the future itself, the idea of our finding that bookended in our present moment seems to suggest that if it's a myth, it's a myth that does a little bit of work. And I'm going to leave it at that.
Yeah. Hannah and I were talking about fossil fuel extraction. And what she said was, it's so crazy that these guys out there, they're in the middle of the ocean and they're just pulling these spirits of dead things out of the ground, then burning them and releasing them to the air, and they think there'll be no consequences. And I said, baby, of course, the return of the repressed.
Yeah, it's spirit cooking, right?
Like, it's spirit cooking. It's the real spirit cooking that's going to end all life on this planet, but the vulnerable life first. All right, Pat, thank you so much. This was a delight. I feel like we could talk for 2 more hours. And as always, please follow Pat on Twitter at Pat Blanchfield. Follow his work and look out for his book, Gunpowder from Verso. Thank you so much, man. And thank you, listeners, for putting up with us.
Thank you. Bye.